Do any of you subscribe to or publish in or look at the Journal of Contraception? Dr. Harvey does, of course, because she's published there many, many times. Contraception is the lead journal in our field, and Dr. Dan Michelle has been the editor of the journal for 42 years, since it was founded in 1970, and last night I was at the dinner honoring him as he has stepped down to be the editor, and Dr. Carolyn Westhoff from Columbia is the new editor for the journal. So if you see that, there's going to be some interesting things. How many of you here are investigators in the field of public health? A couple. How many of you are providers of services? Okay, great, a few. All right. The rest of you can remain anonymous in your things. So we decided to embark upon a curriculum to address the concept of education regarding risk. And this is a series. I have multiple conflicts. Just ask my wife. But I try to spread them out and make sure that everybody is able to buy a piece of me, including the NIH and Population Council. I do have a degree in public health. So I even took me a long time to get through security here. I was able to check finally, and even though waiting had spelled my name wrong and gave me the wrong location of where I was from, I eventually got through. So today we're going to talk about risk a little bit. We're going to look at some of the factors that influence perceptions of risk and define some of the terms that we use to quantify and communicate risk and explain some of the differences between studies and the inferences that we can make and the conclusions that we can draw, and then talk a little bit about risk communication strategies. So, you know, and I've actually noticed that this is a very small group, so it will not offend me in any way if you want to make this somewhat interactive. That keeps you more awake or more interested in any possible way. Just feel free, because I can keep talking regardless of any interruptions. So a risk is the possibility and probability that a loss will occur due to something dangerous or harmful. How we think about risk is something that's actually much more personal, and people in general are much more worried about the types of things that they feel that they really can't control in some way, like earthquakes here in San Francisco on the second floor of a building, which I think is probably safe. Risks that are involuntary, the same, associated with particular dread, closed spaces, are novel, unfamiliar. Man-made risks can be much more afraid of, perhaps because our environment is so dominated by those features, and the risks that are either recalled or talked about. So we bring our perspectives to risk, and I think the last presentation gave us quite a bit of information about cultural features that are involved in understanding even the risk-benefit equation of going into a health clinic to be able to get preventative versus treatment services. Your health literacy, education, language skills, the unique developmental stage in individuals, that all of these things are going to affect our perception of risks. And those of us that are on the front lines as healthcare providers, seeing individual patients of a number of different age groups, know that there are distinct messages. There was a comment about adolescents and IUD use and a concern that maybe providers aren't willing to get the message out due to old dated data. But in many ways, adolescents aren't listening to the provider anyway, and they're coming in with a very, very preconceived notion of what they choose to do. And it may be hard to move that away from something good, like getting an IUD, or away from something bad, like thinking about taking a risk for pregnancy. So there's changes and there's development that occur during adolescence, and I think that most of us are familiar that it takes really to a point of reaching mature adolescence, late in teenage years, before kids are really able to think about and put risks into the terms of themselves. So what about the media? Well, they're out there, okay? If they can sell Mitt Romney, they can do almost anything, Yeah, I hate to say that, but it's true. You know, there if you can package something and repackage things, then that can be good or bad. And when we look in context of health information, everybody loves a story about risk. Everyone loves something that's scary and dicey. And what is more prevalent, universal, and of concern to most women, that the very contraception that they're using in order to protect themselves against the risk of unintended pregnancy may in fact expose them to risk. So the media can be our ally or it can be our adversary. Now, as we recall back in the history of contraception, birth control pills were approved 42 years ago in 1960, and we knew a lot about their effects on inhibiting ovulation. We knew a lot less about their general effects, because it takes large numbers of exposures, as we know, in order to be able to begin to pick up rare events that are occurring. So in 1970, there were hearings in the Senate looking at safety of oral contraception, because there were reports of events like venous thrombosis. And these hearings were extremely interesting to most women. There was a high degree of women following these. About 90% of all reproductive age women were actually listening in to see what was going on. There were awful things that were said, like estrogen is to cancer what fertilizer is to wheat. And consequently, about 20% of women stopped taking oral contraceptives during the hearing. So what do these women do? You know, well, many of them went to a new, improved, small-size intrauterine device that was marketed as particularly appropriate for nulliparous women, that device called the Dalcon Shield. Now, you think, well, that was then, and this is now. Well, 20 years ago, there was the first indications published from large studies that suggested there was an increased risk of venous thrombosis from women using the so-called third-generation progestins, the newer progestins. This information seemed so concerning that the UK Medical Authority issued a Dear Doctor letter to all healthcare providers warning them about this increased risk, with the suggestion to move women to lower risk pills. They also issued media announcements. And as we can see, what occurred during this time is there was actually a big uptick in the rate of abortion because women discontinued oral contraception. So they looked at a very remote risk of venous thrombosis that sounded pretty scary, and then were able to discontinue a method that would prevent that risk and accept the much more greater risk of unintended pregnancy, and this occurred, and it raised the abortion rate, and that was seen in other areas. So I actually believe in science. I love studies. I love qualitative research and hypothesis-generating research, and I love interventional studies and studies that are hypothesis testing. But there are differences in study design and what information they can yield and the type of conclusions that we should draw from that. In general, the very first descriptions are case studies. You know, I saw one of these. Gee, I saw 10 of these. I wonder if anybody else has seen 20 of these, I'm going to report that. That's all interesting, but you want to say compared to what? Okay, so then people oftentimes will say, well, I'll get a bunch of people that don't have that, and I'll see what things that those people did right and what things those people did wrong, and then we'll call that, give us some understanding of what associations might be. That's a case control study, and it's very good for associations. Experimental designs actually take groups that you can control some of the variables and you move them forward. And our gold standard really is a randomized controlled trial, and the reason being is that we can adjust and at least understand ahead of time potential confounders. One of the big things that occurs all the time in communicating risk is the problem that occurs when you have studies that are pointing in a direction. So I think it's critical to be able to understand two concepts called precision and accuracy. Now, if you have a flawed methodology that is extremely consistent, you can get a result like the middle cartoon here that is highly accurate, but it's not precise. You continue to get things that are right on the mark, but it's exactly the wrong mark. So don't confuse accuracy for precision. Now, what we'd like our studies to show us is the last cartoon on the far right, where we see that we have very high consistency, highly accurate, and highly precise. It's telling us what we want to know. So we need to understand what different study designs then can tell us about this so we can move in that direction. Now, as I mentioned, case-controlled studies, case-controlled studies are good for is to help us understand what are associations. But associations don't tell us anything about causality. So it's impossible in that study design to determine causality, but frequently we try to infer causality from case-control studies. So one just needs to be cautious in making some of the conclusions. So let's talk about some of the terms that we use to discuss risk and many of the things that come in mind when we're talking with patients, or patients may come in with information that they've seen in the newspaper. Now, an absolute risk is the events that are occurring within some group or population. So in order to be able to have an absolute risk, you have to understand the entire population risk. So you have to have a numerator and a denominator. And denominators are very, very imprecisely calculated sometimes. But if you have both of those things, then you can get an absolute risk. And that's important when you're looking at the number of cases of new ovarian or breast cancer or the incidence, the absolute risk of a PID for 15-year-olds. But most of the time, we want to know a little bit more. So here's an example of absolute risk. So in a recently published database study from Denmark, 76 women using risperidone oral contraceptives developed a venous thrombosis during 100,000 years of women years of exposure. So that would give us an absolute risk of 76 per 100,000 women years. So what does that mean? Well, what I would tell the medical students, I say, well, compared to what? Okay, and you may need to know what that is. A good way to communicate this is a measure called attributable risk. So what you need to know, understand now is what the incidence or what the risk is in the exposed, and subtract the risk in the unexposed to be able to see what that excess risk is. And that's something that's much more meaningful. So if we take these same data from Lidegaard, we can see that there were 76 women that were exposed to trospirenone who had a venous thromboembolism per 100,000 women years of exposure, and there were 55 among women using levonorgestrel. So that provided an excess or an attributable risk to the use of drospirenone as opposed to levonorgestrel of 21 more cases per 100,000 women. That would be 2.1 cases per 10,000 women, right? So this is what we would be seeing when we're looking at that attributable risk. And that's information that you could communicate in a different way to be far more meaningful to patients. Let's move on to cohorts, though. Cohort designs, again, give us an opportunity to establish a group, and we can learn much more about a group. And when you follow a group through during time, you can determine that there has been an incident event, and you can calculate risk estimates on that. Now, cohort studies are done, two ways. The best way is to say, I want to study something, and I'm going to have all these people are going to be be people I'm going to include in there, and I'm going to exclude women that do this or that, and I'm going to make it as generalizable possible, and I'm going to collect all the data up front on X, Y, and Z that I think are important, and I'm going to expose one group to this and one group not to that. Or I have coal miners here, and they have an exposure, but I can follow them all forward in time. Another way of doing it is to look back and say, gee, you know, I'm a master's student, and I don't have a lot of time and money, but I know that there was groups, there's health records available from this group, from population at time A, and I can go forward with those records and look back at things that occurred, because I can go back 5 years in time. Now, the problem with that is you very frequently don't have all the information on everything that you want, because the people that were collecting that information at the time may not have measured their blood pressure accurately or their weight or height accurately to be able to give you the key information that you need to know. So there are differences in cohort designs. Now, a randomized control study is considered to be sort of the highest potential level of exclusion. I say potential because it all depends upon the methodology used and the rigor of investigators. But in an ideal world, a randomized study is able to allow for the uneven hand to be able to distribute all the potential confounders between groups. And that's what makes randomized studies so powerful if they're done correctly. So all cohort designs then allow us to calculate an estimate called relative risk, which is simply the risk, the frequency of the incident of disease or condition in the exposed divided by the frequency in the unexposed. Let's go back to the Lidegaard data and calculate this. So we can see that there's 76 per 100,000 in the women exposed to dispirinone versus 55 among those not exposed to dispirinone. The denominator 100,000 years cancels out, and we get a relative risk of 1.64, which is slightly less than 2. And as we know, that 2 is considered an association that is a moderate risk that might be important in a lot of studies. So it's an increase, and it's a small increase. So now we like to also look at the precision of that estimate, and a confidence interval is just the boundaries of the point estimate that gives us a measure of precision. And what influences it, as we all know, is sample size and the variance of the measure used for the point estimate. When we're looking at relative risks or odds ratios, the difference is the referent risk is 1, because the numerator and denominator, if they were the same, would be 1 as a quantity. So it's very easy to always remember that. It's important looking at papers, though, because sometimes if you're looking at something like a mean difference, that would be 0 as being in the middle of a confidence interval. So be careful that you're looking at risk estimates. But for odds ratio, relative risks, it's always 1. I like to look at data in this way, that is done with the Cochrane reviews and with other types of analyses for many studies, where you see that you have the referent risk of 1 displayed in the y-axis in the middle of the graph, but with risk estimates to the left side of that favoring protection, and risk estimates to the right favoring an increase in risk. And the bars under these point estimates, the diamonds, would be the exact confidence interval of that. So in the upper one, there's a risk estimate that favors harm. A confidence interval doesn't overlap 1. The far left is the reverse, favors protection, not overlapping 1, and the lowest one overlapping 1, not statistically significant. So I mentioned case studies and case controls. Again, these can highlight association, but they can't give us any information on causality. All they can do is give us some other hypotheses to test. Now, but case control studies are important in terms of being able to look at very rare outcomes. Now, in a case control studies, we get an estimate of risk called the odds ratio, which approximates relative risk, but is not exactly the same mathematically. Let's look back at the World Health Organization collaborative study, looking at the risk of third generation progestins versus second generations. If you do the math across with this, it's 71 over 56 divided by 137 over 203 for a risk estimate of about 1.9. So again, we're seeing about a doubling of risk looking at the... Are you 2 minutes?
Yes, I think we've wrapped up. I ask those of you here, you could stay
That's just fine. It won't offend me if you have to leave at all, because if I were you, I would. But so that's a case control study. So limitations of the studies as we move forward to thinking about just thromboembolism and all the controversy here, because it's in the news, and I think that if you take one thing, look at these two or three more slides, and then take off. What we'd like to be able to think is that our exposure is producing our outcome. When we have randomized control studies, we can look at a lot of outcomes, but they're generally small. It takes a lot of money to be able to do. We can collect a lot of information, but we can't assess rare events. Clinical trials the same way. They tend to be small. Case control and database studies are good because they're cheap to do, because you already have the outcomes collected, but you don't have the ability to assess confounding. And that's the principal limitation that leads these studies to point in particular directions. Now, the biggest confounders for venous thrombosis risk are age. As we get older, we're at higher risk clot, and obesity. As we get heavier, we're at higher risk of clot. And these things actually have a multiplicative effect, so it's critical to be able to understand each of these, and these information are not available in the large database studies like LIDAR that have been published. Now, very recently, there's been a lot of attention to spironone, the FDA had hearings last summer trying to look at these data and look at all the aggregate studies. I think they actually did a favor by not taking drospirenone products off of the market, but requiring a new package insert that said essentially that there may be a higher risk associated with drospirenone. But they actually presented the data this way. And I think this is, again, very nice, because here we have two prospective cohort studies. These were done in the United States and in Europe. They enrolled over 40,000 women and had better than 95% prospective follow-up. So they had information on all the baseline confounders, and they were large enough to look at rare outcomes. These studies showed there was no increase in risk at all. The retrospective cohort studies, the database studies, all were highly accurate, but in my opinion, not very precise. They're off the mark. But we have the information to be able to see, and this is a way of being able to share that with individuals. So I think that in order to communicate risk, you have to be able to understand the measures that are being used. You have to understand a little bit about where the data is coming from and how you're doing that. There's a number of ways to sort of communicate this to patients that are a little bit easier. Try to use numbers that work in different ways. 3 out of 10 develop nausea, 30% chance of nausea. Same thing, but the concept resonates differently to different individuals. Very commonly, we use math inappropriately in ways that's hard to understand. Headache develops in 1 in 333 women is confusing. It's more easy to communicate the headache develops in 3 of 1,000. Try to keep your denominators the same so that people can actually appreciate what that risk is. Use absolute risks. The papers are always liking to report there's a 25% increased risk of cancer if you eat tomato juice on Thursdays. Use absolute numbers. Like there's 2 more cases of venous thrombosis per 10,000 women who use drospirenone-containing pills in the database studies, or heart attack occurs in 4 out of every 1 million OC users. And rare events need to be communicated as such. Provide comparisons that will actually help women. 16 out of 100,000 users of low-dose OCs have a venous thrombosis. Boy, that sounds scary until you think about being pregnant, okay, where the risk really is. using a number of different tools, charts sometimes can be able to put these risks in perspective, and particularly for younger patients, this may be a way more visually to help communicate that the pregnancy is a very, very high risk and also a likely risk in non-using contraception, whereas using a hormonal contraceptive is quite a low risk in comparison. We all know that the riskiest thing you can do is be driving your car to your appointment smoking a cigarette. Now, that's far more risky than anything else that could occur when you get to our health visit. This is a nice way of being able to communicate risk. There's 1,000 individuals in this Palin palette, so we're talking about emergency contraception effectiveness. We can see that 80 out of 1,000 women not using emergency contraception and exposed to a risk of pregnancy would get pregnant. We'd get about 20 out of 100 using the old Yuzby method, but only 10 out of 1,000 for women using levonorgestrel plan B, 5 women using Ella, the oloprestol acetate, but only 1 among women having a copper IUD inserted. So this is a very, very quick little visual to be able to put all that complicated information into perspective. I want to give my tip of the hat to Wayne and ARHP for putting together a lot of great information and programs that are helpful, I think, to clinicians and to educators to help gain perspective on this. Look at editorials. Look at people that you can really trust to be able to interpret literature and be able to tell you when something seems like it's maybe pointing you in the wrong direction. Be wary of database studies and be wary of case control studies, unless they're the only information that you have. If that's the highest level of data that you have, you got to go with it. When better data is available, move in that way. So I will leave you with that, and I appreciate your attention, and I'll take any questions that you have about this. I have a clinician's point of view on other issues that may be important. I'm here for a couple more hours before I fly to San Antonio, so entertain me. So thanks very much.